Okay, I could listen to this all day long. That's Jimmy Smith on his Hammond B3 with The Sermon. It's the 20-minute, 12-second title track of his 1958 album, which also features Lee Morgan on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Tina Brooks on tenor, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and we're picking up from where we left off with each other just yesterday, talking about the Clinton Foundation, and we stopped at taking your questions, and we'll continue that today. There were more people than time allotted, so we are going to make time today for those who did not get on the air yesterday. The Clinton Foundation, a case of twisted philanthropy, if ever there was one. The Clinton Foundation and its principals are about to come under even heavier fire as November the 15th looms before them. It's their final deadline to submit to the IRS a mountain of missing paperwork, reports, and documentation for how they have been running their multi-million dollar global nonprofit. Charles Ortel is a retired Wall Street banker turned financial investigator, and his self-initiated investigation proved that several Wall Street traded companies had been overvaluing their stocks by hundreds of billions of dollars during the time of the 2008-2009 stock crash. He has spent the last 2 years, as you know, examining closely the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, the formal name of the Clinton Foundation, as we call it, and has declared it a, quote, total fraud, unquote, and, quote, the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in U.S. history. He was with us yesterday, giving us the latest installment, and has been sharing his findings, as you know, on the foundation and detailed reports on Lead Stories, and returns today to answer your specific questions at 888-874-4888. And once we dispatch your questions, we'll move on, if we have time, to another aspect of the Clinton Foundation. But suffice it to say, things are really getting tight. And we expect, of course, that in anticipation of that, we will expect a lot of legal action moving against the Clintons, especially after November the 15th. That's 8 days from now. By midnight, they're supposed to have all this in, and we will learn from the papers they submit whether even then they are in compliance. Charles, great to have you with us once more.
Well, thanks for having me back on, Utrice.
We waiting for calls. Several people were not able to get to you yesterday, and I'm hoping that they will get to you today. But until they do, what are you learning just before we go on air?
Sure. I don't know that we have enough time to answer that question, but basically, one thing that is really extraordinary is what's going on in Saudi Arabia and what I believe are the likely links between those actions in Saudi Arabia to the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation. So there are three very large names in Saudi Arabia that have been identified as having been detained and perhaps their wealth either blocked or confiscated. One, of course, is the very notorious Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, who I think is the richest of the group. Another is a man called Sheikh Al-Moody, who's business interests are heavily concentrated in Ethiopia, but also around the Middle East. And the last is a man whose name I may slaughter, but I think it's spelled A-M-R and then D-A-B-B-A-G-H. I may have that. I think I have that right. Anyway, all three of these names are people identified with the Clinton Foundation, and some of them are identified in the crucial period, the early period when the both when the Little Rock complex was being constructed, and then as at the same time in 2002, 3, and 4, Bill Clinton and Ira Magaziner ill-advisedly broke the law by using this presidential library as a platform to claim that they were fighting HIV/AIDS around the world when they weren't authorized to do so. So what I suspect could be happening here is that whoever is going after this gigantic fraud, and I know it's perhaps gilding the lily, I mean, or tooting my own horn a little bit. I actually think I said it's the largest unprosecuted fraud in the history of the world, because you know the United States is the biggest economy by far. So if it were the biggest in the United States, it would most likely be the biggest in the world. And as a guess, what people thought through is that the United States legal process is one where defense lawyers can mount all kinds of defenses to slow your ability to get the paperwork that you want to get. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, not so much. In Saudi law, you basically are this, you know, under the thumb of the monarchy. And, you know, in this recent raid, assuming that the Crown Prince, who apparently everyone is calling him by his initials, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. If MBS survives this, and there are going to be a lot of, there already are a lot of people who are very upset about it, should he survive, he will have the ability and his team will have the ability, and I hope they're already doing it, to get copies of multiple legal documents, which must have been created in connection with any donations routed towards the Clinton, any investments in any Clinton scheme. They must have lawyers inside, I mean, sorry, copies inside the kingdom, Saudi Arabia, of these documents, which the Saudis can get a lot faster than even we can, even our vaunted FBI when it was, you know, it's operating 100%. I don't think they could round the papers up as fast as the Saudis will be able to do that. Now, why is this important? All government contributions and all contributions by companies that are controlled by governments to a foundation need to be listed out under New York law and under California law. They're very strict forms. And in addition, in the Clinton filings, the federal forms are supposed to link, put all this stuff out. So far, the Clintons have not seen fit. And I would imagine they didn't want to really amend the documents properly until they knew the election result last year. They probably were hoping that Hillary would have won. And but so far, the Clinton Foundation has not amended its historical returns for 1998 through 2015 the way they need to do it, to list out these government contributions consistently year by year all the way into that period. So they face, I mean, what happens in Saudi Arabia is not going to stay in Saudi Arabia. It's going to ripple around the world. There are other Gulf kingdoms that have given money that isn't disclosed properly. There are many other governments that have given money that hasn't been disclosed properly. And the analogy I would suggest here is as if, you know, there's been a Don Juan roaming around the world who's got, you know, 500 wives and mistresses all over the world, each one thinking that Don Juan is, you know, is hers alone. And suddenly all these mistresses and wives or whatever have figured out that Don Juan is a mega cheater, and they're now starting to compare notes. And as they compare notes, the bad news is going to, you know, burn up the computers, burn up the phone lines, burn up the fax machines, and leave the Clinton Foundation in a place where no auditor can actually render an audit by the deadline. And the real pressure, I think, at this moment is going to start to build on, if it's Price Waterhouse, which was the auditor from the last several years, if Price Waterhouse is in the middle of an audit thinking that they're going to try to get one done, by in time to have the filing go in on the 15th by midnight, November 15th, 2017, Price Waterhouse is going to find out that they have massive conflicts of interest. They are a very big firm. Obviously, they all try to manage their conflicts. But in this case, when you really pull on the strings the way people I have and others around me have, you discover that there are multiple messes here where Price Waterhouse has in the past been auditing the Clinton Foundation. They've been auditing a company called Laureate Education. I don't know if they're still doing that. Neither the Clinton Foundation nor Laureate have properly accounted for the individual results of both entities and then the conflicted, the related party transaction results involving both entities. So in the case of the Clinton Foundation, in the case of Laureate and the Clinton Foundation, we've talked about this in the past. Bill Clinton and by extension his wife Hillary had a five-year deal. I don't know whether it was a five-year contract struck in 2010 or a year-by-year deal, wherein what we know so far is that Bill Clinton was paid $17.6 million for part-time work over the course of 5 years. Now, that information is not disclosed in any Clinton Foundation filings. It does not appear to be disclosed in the Laureate filings that I've seen, that Laureate had a joint venture with the Clinton Global Initiative called the Clinton Global Initiative University. There's no legal documentation that I've seen filed in either entity for that. There's no record that Clinton Global Initiative University was registered in New York State where it would need to be registered, to use the word university, or in any of the other states where it operated. There's no record that the Clinton Global Initiative was organized validly in 2005 when it first started soliciting and holding meetings. In 2005 through 2009, the Clinton Global Initiative application to be a charity that was filed in 2010 does not fairly disclose its history. And I could go on and on and on. So all of these issues are coming into sharp focus around the world in the many states, the many foreign countries. And now another little ripple that we could discuss that is affects the university that I hold dear to my heart, Yale. Sheikh Al-Moody is somebody who, if you remember last year in the WikiLeaks, there were cables where, you know, they're actually sort of funny to read, where this man with extensive interests in Ethiopia had paid a commitment, a multi-year pledge of, I want to say, $20 million, $2 million a year for 10 years. And there was banter back and forth that, you know, this donor, you know, was demanding that Bill fly out somewhere. I forget if it was Ethiopia or Saudi Arabia. If the foundation expected to get their $2 million and they were trying to think through, should Bill do it? Should he not do it? And why is this all interesting? Well, one of the big projects that this man was funding was an HIV/AIDS effort that was in coordination with an entity whose authority to operate had been involuntarily revoked in the headquarters state of Commonwealth of Massachusetts on March 31st, 2008, with a retroactive effect to 31 December 2007. So when you pull the press releases that are still on file, this Ethiopian project was very much moving along, and it was moving along in concert also with Yale and a professor at Yale who, I think, either was completely bamboozled by the Clinton Foundation, never checked any of the paperwork to make sure that the Clinton Foundation actually was authorized to fight HIV/AIDS, yet worked with them for multiple years, or was a part of this project and gaining some benefit for herself and for who knows who else, as the Clinton Foundation likely procured adulterated HIV/AIDS drugs manufactured either by Ranbaxy or by a company called Hetero, H-E-T-E-R-O, that has fallen under suspicion here. So it is a very tangled mess, and it is quite clear that the trustees did not do their job at any Clinton entity. It is also clear that many of these trustees are super smart people who have no excuse to say that they didn't see this, other than if you tilt the scale and say, well, everyone looked at this. Everyone expected the inevitable Queen Hillary to become president of the United States. And everybody, you know, around us said, well, you know, we'll look the other way because when she becomes president, we'll have that just that much more influence over the United States and the Clinton administration, and we can get a lot back in the form maybe of, you know, support for our universities, contracts, deals, et cetera. So, you know, this is, I think, a wake-up call is coming on the 15th of November, 2017. All the moralizing that comes out of the academia talking about for-profit land, I think it's time to switch focus and ask ourselves, has the academia and does the charity world need to really get serious about regulating? And do we need to have a deep inquiry along the lines of the PCORA Commission after the crash and the Great Depression into the whole area of charities? Because it's such a big area. We have $5 trillion in assets locked inside charities. And at least with regard to the many who have contributed, the Gates Foundation and others, to the Clinton Foundation, it's crystal clear that many, many people who should have known better have been abusing the law, and their actions have led to, it would seem, that the treasuries, federal, state, foreign treasuries, have suffered massive losses in their tax revenues as a result of the behavior of the Clinton Foundation and its affiliates, in my opinion.
Well, that is on the domestic front. Things are heating up on the foreign front, with several governments now questioning what happened to the hundreds of millions of dollars given to the Clinton Foundation. What's happening there in terms of looking to get that money back?
There you go again, Yatrice, asking that question. What happened? But anyway, I think what's happening now is when you there's something called the Club de Madrid, and there's another thing I think called the Elders. Both are societies for former presidents and leaders of countries and high muckety mucks to swan around the world claiming that they're doing good things. And maybe it started before Clinton, but certainly with Clinton, Bill Clinton. If you look around the world, there are quite a few foreign leaders who, towards the end of their tenures in France, in England, in Australia, and elsewhere, in many other countries, in Finland and stuff, they decide that they need to have their own foundation. And what we have, I think, is an incestuous relationship where people look at what President Obama is now doing with his foundation. World leaders are able to set these foundations up. And, you know, as you see with Bill Clinton's foundation, you mentioned it's declared $2 billion in revenue. It's never been controlled properly. It's never had a valid audit. So, you know, when you have a popular, as Bill was very controversial but popular, you have a popular leader retire. They've become comfortable dealing with billionaires and very rich people around the world. You can't really live in a, you know, studio apartment in Bayonne, New Jersey after you're president of the United States. You got to have something to live in. And your family's grown accustomed to Air Force One and Marine One and things like that. So around the world, these people have been emulating one another. And while they're still leaders of the country, signing up for long-term deals. I'm thinking, for example, in Australia. You know, there's a great man in Australia called Michael Smith, great investigative journalist who's been trying to get the Australian government to care about the roughly $100 million that government sent towards the Clinton Foundation, which doesn't appear to have ended up inside the Clinton Foundation's books. And, you know, they don't seem to be caring about it. In other countries like France, which investigated the conduit, Unitaid, that it had contributed money to, not hundreds of millions, in the case of France's contributions to Unitaid exceed $1 billion, a majority of the money that France gave that Unitaid gave to anybody in the years 2006 to 2009 went to this illegally organized and operated HIV/AIDS operation in Massachusetts. And they investigated this starting in December 2009. France investigated Unitaid, but they didn't get to the truth while Hillary was still Secretary of State. I wonder why that was. So, I'm sorry, one second. So you have that. And you have other countries. You have the United Kingdom has been curiously reticent. They have given another gigantic contributor to UNITAID at a time when UNITAID was giving money to the Clinton Foundation. They also had many one-off deals from the UK into Clinton Foundation operations at a time where they weren't appropriately organized and operated. In the case of Norway, that's another big donor. The local press in Norway is looking at this, asking tough questions. But, of course, the Norwegian politicians don't want to admit that either they were duped or they were part of the conspiracy to divert money from the Norwegian treasury back into the hands of Norwegian politicians and their friends. So, I think it's high time for people around the world, and particularly in the United States, who have let these high-living, luxury-loving, globalist politicians jump around the world to stand up and answer to, we the people. I mean, it's tough to balance your books yourself. It's tough to keep your job. People are in the private sector worried about their jobs. Why should we let people, operate these foundations that nobody checks and then go around the world paying themselves $250,000 per speech to brag about all their charitable good works as they go from limousine to presidential suite to private plane? So I think it's time, and this is not a partisan issue. I think there are, lots of people on the left who look at this and say, what? And there's certainly lots of people on the right the same way, and there are people who are apolitical. You just don't behave like this with charities. And we need to use this as a case study of what happens when absolute power corrupts absolutely. We need to see how egregious was this behavior. Then we need to get the money back. We need to do to the people who've been doing this the equivalent of what MBS, that is the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, has done. We must have a nice, I wouldn't use the Ritz-Carlton or whatever is here in New York. I'd use a Quality Inn or a Latina Inn. And we need to find these people, put them in one of those inns, make it impossible for them to access their bank accounts, and then figure out how much money has been stolen here and get it back.
Well, from four people alone in Saudi Arabia, supposedly they're able to claw back as much as $33 billion. This business of philanthropy and starting foundations, I don't think it would be a stretch to say that this is a new wave of organized crime. When you have leaders who have left office, and the minute they get in, they start planning and planting their people strategically, who would help them amass an extraordinary fortune even after they leave office. And I wonder, what is international law saying about this, and is there some international law, apart from the laws of the respective countries that govern philanthropy and taxes and so forth, is there any international regulation, a body that is keeping track of philanthropic organizations and foundations that might look a little bit suspicious?
Well, it's a great question, Yatrice. Actually, international activity by charities is a small percentage of the total activity, judging by the advanced economies. I'm familiar pretty much with the statistics of the United States. There's $5.2 trillion or so, $5 trillion, let's call it, of assets in all the charities as of the end of 2015. I would say as a guess, 10 to 20% of those assets might be devoted internationally, with the overwhelming majority concentrated on the large hospital systems, the large university systems, the large charities, that have, many people and employees and, real estate here inside this country. And the U.S. economy, as we've talked about in the past, is so disproportionately large relative to the rest of the world, that really we needn't worry about foreign people trying to solve this domestic problem. we've got to put enormous pressure, and I can tell you that pressure is now finally mounting in the Senate, the House, and the FBI, the IRS. Different states are beginning to finally say, listen, this is out of control, and we got to do something about it. Because we can't let the Obama Foundation emulate the Clinton Foundation. And to the extent the Bush Foundation and the Carter Foundation, if it is, are doing the same thing, and the Gates Foundation, whatever, we've got to use this as an object lesson to teach these people that you can't run riot through a charity. So there is no empowered, that I know of, international regulator for anything. And I think it'll likely going to be a long time before one emerges. I think what we have in the UN and now the WHO and other large regulatory bodies are things that are meant to seduce the public into believing there is some sort of protection, when in reality there isn't any. You know, for the UN and these multilateral bodies, they don't pay taxes typically in the local country. They're not really regulated. You know, look at the stream of oddballs who's run the United Nations. Look at all the tragedies that happen around the world. Look at the fact that the United Nations came together after the folly that was the League of Nations. And, you know, is there a year on this planet since the end of World War II where we have not had a major conflict somewhere? Given that there isn't one, what in the heck do we need the UN for? It provides a semblance of, you know, it's another bureaucracy. It's a great boon to restaurant owners and catering services and the travel industry, but it's not really doing much. And I think, you know, I think we really do need to stop designing government bureaucracies that are massive and meant to cure all ills, when what we can do is pick apart, you know, specific problems and address them. In the charity world of the United States, a simple approach we could take would be like, for those of us who spent a lot of time in England, as I have, you know, you have the Queen will give an appointment. You have to go through a process, and you see these nice gilded little things that are supposed to tell you whether it's an officially authorized vendor to the Queen. We should do a similar idea with charities. We should have a really strict group that is properly resourced, that is the only group that can authorize a charity. And if you're going to register to solicit, you're going to have to be validly authorized. And there should be a clearinghouse where one state will know the situation in every other state, so that you can't have this situation where, you know, the Clinton Foundation is constantly changing its name a little bit, different offices and different initiatives. Nobody seems to know what it's actually doing. The books and records have never been right. You should have one central clearinghouse where you can say, this thing is or is not a validly organized and operated charity. The senior people involved with it have or have not engaged in practices that are, you know, give rise to suspicion, as many people associated with the Clinton Foundation and its affiliates have. And you shouldn't make it the kind of project where somebody like me has to spend 2.5 years figuring it out. It should be able to figure it out immediately. And so,
well, you mentioned the Queen, and she has a little problem with an offshore account amounting to $13 million. So everybody's in this, apparently, except me and you.
Well, if I could comment on that for a second, Eutrice, when you invest money internationally, it is a very complicated exercise. And I think it is in the interest of economies like the United Kingdom, the United States, to have people invest internationally. And what is an important disclaimer on the Paradise Papers website is that so far they haven't found evidence of illegal activity by the Queen. It's just that she happens to have a small portion of her wealth in one or more international funds that are structured through a Bermuda or offshore vehicle. That's not unusual at all. There's nothing wrong per se with that. What is wrong is if, for example, some group of people in Saudi Arabia decided that they were going to put Hillary Clinton and the Clintons back in the White House, because the Clintons, you know, may have proven themselves in the past adept at turning any investment in a campaign contribution into returns many fold back. If foreign nationals are buying domestic politicians, that's a big problem. But if, you know, John Kerry, you know, is married to a very wealthy widow who has multiple investments around the world and has had for a long time, the H.J. Heinz fortune, you know, the Catcher people. And, you know, many, many people who are wealthy allocate a portion of their assets into such funds. And I don't think, per se, there's anything wrong with that, provided the federal disclosure forms and other forms are fully filled out. In the Queen's case, again, you know, even if it's $100 million relative to the vast wealth that the royal family has in real estate, treasures, and other things, that doesn't shock me in the slightest. Now, you want to pick somebody else, Bono would be somebody that I would definitely have a problem with. He's spent the last 25, 30 years lecturing the world about inequality and this and that. Now we find out, you know, the guy's sitting there, you know, shrewdly investing through tax havens and this and that. I mean, there's a certain amount of cynical unctuousness out of Bono that I think deserves, the world needs to think about a little bit.
Well, we did say that today Charles would be available to answer your questions, but nobody's asking questions. So apparently you've done a great job or are doing a great job of explaining things, or people just don't want to talk to you.
Probably the latter.
But the number is 888-874-4888. This is being done so that this audience, and I will say this very proudly, this audience has the best and most intimate and detailed understanding of the operations of the Clinton Foundation and a greater appreciation, therefore, of the relationship between the Clintons and the rest of us. Where the money goes, we don't know, but we certainly are interested in finding out. We're talking today about November the 15th being a crucial day, because by then the foundation has to come up with the paperwork that has been missing for so many years about where the money is coming from and where it has gone, where it went. So we're talking about the Clinton Foundation, and we started talking about the Clinton Foundation as the epicenter of a network of criminal activity that enmeshes a whole bunch of people who seem to be separate and distant from the Clinton Foundation, but really are not. We are learning about all these enterprises that have been spread all over the world. They sham operations, and they have done untold amounts of damage. Dazinia from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi. I have been listening to the program, and I've learned so much, but it makes me feel so small because I see so much of criminal activity right here in my personal life when I go to deal with the housing courts or the legal system or anything. Everything just seems to be magnified once you get insight and information. At first, you just think it's bureaucratic, you know, laziness, or, and then you start to dig deeper and you're like, no, this is a pattern. I wish that I had George Ortel in my back pocket when I go to deal with some of these bureaucratic situations. I mean, I know that his sharp eye would be able to say, no, this is what you're seeing, because I have been so enlightened by his show or you having him on your show that I suspect everybody doing something wrong.
You know, this is a legitimate feeling, and I'm glad that you raised it, because this is one of the unintended consequences, Charles, I think, of the Clinton Foundation and how it has been operating. And that is, I mean, Dazinia called it feeling small. We do feel small when we have this magnitude of criminality and nothing is done about it, and people feel small, but beyond that, they also feel angry. Because how is it that these folks get away with billions, and you at one point said, if you were to put this all together, we're talking about trillions of dollars in various foundations behaving badly. And the regular person would never be allowed this much elastic. And we have the Clintons getting away not just with this foundation, but in practically every endeavor they have undertaken. What's your view?
One last thing, so, Mr. Chase.
My view?
Sorry. It was one last thing. I was here in Brooklyn about 2 weeks ago, and there was an area in Fulton Street and Fort Greene. It was so many people, mostly women, very, very few of what we call the flies in the milk. I couldn't imagine what was the big hoopla. And come to find out that Hillary Clinton was going to be book signing at Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn. And I was livid. I was like, I wanted to just stand and talk to everybody on that line, like, do you know what I know? Do you know what I found out? Do you know about this radio station? I said, these people will go to no end. Come to Brooklyn in the middle of Fulton Street. I said, boy, the times have changed.
Well, she was at Medgar Evers College making the commencement address.
Well, that's one I threw up in my mouth.
Treated her there as a major, major personality. So I'm not surprised that she would show up on Fulton Street to sign her book. But Charles, what do you think about what Desenia has just said?
Well, I think that with regard to the Clintons and the people, some of the people around them, I think their goal was to basically render the existing system, the system they may loathe, a joke. You know, they're happy to see the justice system, the integrity of the justice system ruined. I mean, look at his behavior while he was in the White House. Look at the many scandals that have dogged this couple all over the place. They should be permanently barred from holding, obviously, any office. That would include Chelsea and her husband and, you know, all these people. But beyond that, you know, the penalty, I think, at Harvard, I don't think Yale does this, but at Harvard, if you get a rapscallion, who would have tried something not remotely as bad as this, you expunge them from the records. They go back, even if you got a degree, they get rid of your application, they get rid of your record, they take you out of the record book. That's what should happen with these people, not for what they did in political life, but for what they did in the charitable world. Because they have really, I mean, in order for us to move past these wounds, to heal these wounds, we've got to identify them, we've got to expose them, we've got to treat them, and we've got to learn from the healing process. We can't do that by sweeping this under the rug. The second reaction I would have is, you know, we do, and I'm actually one of the people guilty of this, joke about the system of justice in Saudi Arabia and the idea that maybe Saudi Arabia was going to chair up the UN Human Rights Commission. But wouldn't it be more than just a little funny that the cruel system of justice, I mean, justice is swift and merciless in Saudi Arabia. Just go to the local square in Riyadh where they, you know, decapitate people on a regular basis for sometimes relatively trivial offenses. You know, wouldn't it be more than a bit rich that it's Saudi Arabia that and their behavior and their revelations that prod the United States to live out the great promise the founders hoped we would have, that no one is above the law, not even a president, whereas the founders had come from a tradition where kings and queens were effectively the law. And many of them behaved as if they were far above the law. Ancient times, ruling by divine right. Wouldn't it be ironic that a monarchy would try to teach this democracy, this republic, a thing or two about holding powerful people to account? That would be one heck of a lesson.
We have Randolph from Montreal. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, Eutrice. Charles, I hope it's okay to call you Charles. I really don't know you, but I
sure,
was listening.
Sure.
Good. What is sad is that I believe that a lot of people don't understand the implications of what this situation is really producing. When can you imagine that families are being foreclosed on their houses for contracts which the banks are using the letter of the law to throw these people and their entire lifetimes out on the street when soldiers are homeless because the organization that should be taking care of them, it could go bankrupt because of the claims on them. People, what trust is being annihilated, I mean, in their everyday life? How people...
But Randolph, do you have a question about the foundation?
Well, do... Well, what about trust?
I'll give you one. I'll let you off.
Okay,
I was trying to push you in the direction of a question about the foundation, but let's have you finish your thought.
Okay. I mean, isn't it undermining everyday life and trust between people who sign contracts and people who look for some type of security and their daily lives? Isn't this undermining everyday life that people expect to have certain trusts?
Well, we did get that sentiment from Dazinia's question. Charles, what's your answer?
I would say absolutely, and it's you know, particularly sad. I mean, this morning I was turning on the television, and it happened to be Fox that I landed on, and it was very early in the morning. It's 5 o'clock in the morning or so, and there was an ad that went on forever. It seemed to go on for 90 seconds with pictures of these, you know, animals and their plane of eyes and somebody earnestly asking you to sign up for $19 a month. And, you know, those ads are expensive, even though they're early in the morning. And at this time of year, as it gets cold, you know, and as we end near the end of the tax year, the appeals for charities, you know, start bombarding us nonstop, whether it's the Shriners Hospital or you name it. Everybody wants $19 a month. It's less than 63 cents a day. It's the same spiel. And an industry seems to have grown up where, you know, charlatans, and I'm not saying I have studied this particular one, but anytime I see a television ad for a charity, I'm very suspicious. You know, there's this industry that's grown up where people take advantage. They stand between the victim and the donor, and they take their cut. And to me, that is, you know, there's so much great charity that is done by people who don't actually take a tax deduction for it or want notice for it. They do it because they just want to help, and they don't want it to be a burden on the recipient. They just want to lend a hand and see the person heal. So, yes, I think it is very distressing. What's even more distressing is that your government, Canada, not in Quebec, but the federal government of Canada, I think, recently announced a number of weeks, months ago, that notwithstanding all the problems that are well known and notwithstanding the very checkered relationship that your government has had over many years, going back to 2002, with fake Clinton charities, notwithstanding all that, you signed up prospectively to send more money to the Clinton to, in theory, fight HIV/AIDS, in theory, in Nigeria, which is not actually, I think it's Nigeria, which Nigeria is not a poor country. You know, so why Canada should feel the need to send anything to Nigerians is beyond me. You know, your own country, your own people are still supporting this Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Health Access Initiative and the Clinton Climate Change, which is a complete hoax, not climate change, but the Clinton Climate Change Initiative, complete hoax, never legally organized. Why your government is continuing to do that, it just baffles me. And why Canadian citizens, you know, aren't saying, you know what, we don't want to, our taxes are high enough. You know, we send it into the central treasury, you know, for the federal government. We send it into our provincial governments. And these governments are throwing money at frauds. What's that all about? That's my
thanks, reason. Randolph, for your question. We have Michael from New Jersey. You're on the air. Michael with Charles Rortel.
Hi, Utrice. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And good afternoon, Charles.
My question has
to do with how do you break through the impermeable kind of gatekeepers in the FBI, because they seem to be at the center of this. Comey and Mueller, they seem to be at the center of the bullseye, that they're the gatekeepers that prevent, if there's a deep state or anything, they're like the J. Edgar Hoovers here. And they have so much power that nobody can oversight. I know that the Justice Department is oversight, and the Congress, investigative bodies in the government are supposed to overlook them. But it doesn't seem like when you have a person like Comey coming before the Congress and the kind of thing that he got away with, we can go into it, but it seems like the FBI is at the center of this whole inability to get at the center of these issues of the Clinton Foundation and this pay-to-play scheme and all that. How would you go about it? Now, it seems like the Clinton is like a organized crime. And you go back and look at like the Corleone family and that great film. How did they investigate and prosecute the organized crime? This is the same kind of thing. This has to be brought to bear. I'll listen to your comments.
That's a great question. So, you know, it takes time. I realized when I started on this in February 2015, that before the election, before the candidates were known, that we weren't going to solve this in even a matter of months. And this isn't a small problem. I mean, it's not like we're trying to just paint the side of a house here. I mean, this is a dynastic, more than one dynastic political family, the Clintons and also the Bushes are in here, and foreign dynastic political families are involved in this, and the amounts of money are massive, and the implications are big. So it does take time. But what I realized here, unlike General Electric, which is a story that is partially told, and took actually less time to expose. In a charity fraud, you have one major weapon, and that is that you don't have to prove the fraud. You don't have to prove that people knowingly, they had intent to defraud. All you need to do is prove the documents are false and materially misleading, and that solicitation occurred while these documents were in the public domain, using the mails, using telephone, using the Internet. And that the facts are there. The question is the political will. Is the political will there? And I think by pushing hard, as people have been doing on states, foreign governments, by now drawing attention to this 15th of November 2017 looming deadline, 8 days away, where there are no good choices for the Clintons and the trustees. It's a question. You have choice A, which is confess to fraud and, you know, beg for mercy, and choice B, which is commit additional fraud and hope that the Trump administration doesn't catch you. You don't have any good choices. And the world is watching, and people like you and people who are asking these questions, more and more pressure is being put on this. And I'm hopeful that we'll actually get to the bottom of this, fully expose it, and then it'll be the opposite, or actually be similar to a line from in The Old Man and the Sea, I think it was. Somebody's asked, you know, how do you go bankrupt? And I think it's how do you go bankrupt? And the answer is slowly, then suddenly. How do you get caught for charity fraud if you're a big political figure? Slowly and then suddenly.
Thanks, Michael, for your question. Jay from New York, you're on with Charles Rortel.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Rortel. With all of the investigation and all of the information that you putting out over the last year and a half, I'm wondering why hasn't there been any sort of real investigation on the part of the United States government leading to maybe an indictment or some sort of revoking of the foundation, like they did with Donald Trump's foundation here in New York, because it seems like she's basically getting away with all of this. And, you know, I mean, when is this going to come to a head? Because I know if you listen to most of the other mass media and you bring this up to other radio hosts, they know nothing about this. They don't even know who you are. And when you give them your name and information where they can go and investigate these things that you're saying, they truly dismiss you as being a fraud. And, you know, I've been listening to what you've been saying for the last year and a half since you've been on Utrecht Show, and I've been pushing your information every chance that I get, but it just seems like it's not catching the type of traction that one would hope that it would. And I was wondering, what could one do other than keep on putting your name out there to make it do what it do? Because she has to be stopped, because she's not a good woman.
Well, thank you for that. I think, and I really appreciate the fact that you're doing what you're doing. And frankly, you know, up until August of 2007, I was somebody who just, you know, assumed that we were paying enough money to the various bureaucrats and government people that they would take care of any problems, and that I didn't need to get involved. But when I saw the looming global credit crisis coming, I decided I had to start, you know, participating. And I would say, you know, contact your congressperson, contact the attorney general, contact your senator, contact, you know, any friends that you have, tweet to these people. I am seeing, you know, an increase, a steady increase, actually a swift increase in interest around the world in this. And I think, you know, it was a case where nobody really wanted, prior to the November 2016 election result being known, nobody wanted to be the first person to cross Madam President Clinton. So I think there were quite a few people who were scared of what she might do and that people around her might do had she won. Then after Trump won, it has taken, you go through this, whatever they are, the four stages of grief, and I don't think the most ardent Clinton supporters are through those stages yet. And, you know, a lot here in New York, a lot of the, even though the Clintons are not from New York, I think even though they're making a mockery of this city and state, you know, they have a lot of connected allies in the New York City and New York State governments. So it's not surprising here that it would be tough to break the wall of the blue wall or whatever it's called. But even in New York, and even given that Mr. Schneiderman loathes apparently Donald Trump for various reasons, I'm starting to see a glimmer of hope that even Mr. Schneiderman's office may actually do the work that he's supposed to do and go into this charity, because they have the filing inside this New York City, sorry, and state, the State Charity Bureau has filings. They have resources. They have smart people. They have the ability to see that this is the fraud that it is. And they have fearsome powers that could be applied to assist the federal government, to assist the other state governments, to expose this for what it is, get to the bottom of it, make a full disclosure, and then assess the appropriate state penalties and get the restitution that the people of the state of New York and city of New York are owed here. So I appreciate the time that you take listening to this show. I'm delighted to hear that you're so interested, and thanks for all your help.
But I just don't see how in New York that they would do anything to Hillary Clinton, because she's basically an honorary New Yorker by being the past senator of the state. So I just don't see New York doing anything. But, you know, all we can do is just keep on trying to push forward the information. Have a good day.
Excellent questions, everyone. Thank you so much. But that brings us to the end of our program today, and I'm glad that we were able to get two things done. Charles, you were able to add some more to what we now know about the Clinton Foundation, and we know to fix our eyes on November the 15th, and the questions were very very good and allowed us to branch out a little more in addressing them. So thank you, Charles, and thank you, callers. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. And I thank you for being with us today. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.